The Lead Story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, insight, advice, impact.
Welcome to the Business Report. Our lead story this evening concerns an energy source that we've spent many hours discussing and from various different sources, and it's about green hydrogen. Joining me in studio is Roland Brown, co-founder at Cirrus. Welcome back, Roland.
Thanks for having me again.
Now, you recently wrote an article that's being distributed that I thought would be interesting to just sit and delve into a little bit, with specific reference to green hydrogen and more specific reference to the use of public funds thereof. We'll get to that in a second, but let's perhaps just first start out with the energy source itself. Now, physics and economics don't always collide effectively. Sometimes we have to do things that are cost ineffective for our very survival, and sometimes we do things because they are cost effective. Let's perhaps just start out with green hydrogen, and we'll get into the other colors of hydrogen in a second, but green hydrogen itself is effectively using wind and solar to produce a hydrogen molecule and the systems around that. You've been on record a number of times as being fairly critical of a lot of the hype and a positive press that's being put out at the moment around green hydrogen, more specifically in a Namibian context. Perhaps let's just start out with that. What is wrong with green hydrogen?
Wow, that's quite a broad question. I would say the first thing is we're not at all concerned about the pursuit of this energy source in and of itself. But I think that the principal problems with it do lead to some broader concerns around public funding, which you mention and which we discuss in this article. The first thing that we just note around this production of green hydrogen specifically is that it is relatively expensive when compared to other hydrogen sources. And in order for that to matter, you have to kind of understand hydrogen and the use of hydrogen potentially in the world, why we're looking at this, thinking about it in general. And so I think that's kind of the first fundamental thing. So why are we talking about hydrogen as a fuel source in general is quite important. So there, the situation that sort of precipitates all of this is this climate change. Used to be called global warming. Now it's sort of more referred to as climate change concern. And the idea that that climate change is largely driven by the use of fossil fuels by man. And that view, that understanding, has led to the pursuit of alternative energy sources from fossil fuel-based energy sources. So hydrogen is obviously a hyperabundant molecule. It is a molecule that has, if you combust hydrogen, it produces water as a byproduct, as opposed to greenhouse gas emissions from hydrocarbons. And so from that perspective, it's viewed to be one of the potential solutions to reducing fossil fuel use. So when it comes to the general use of fossil fuels globally, we see the primary areas in which it's used in energy production, so electricity production. And there's been a huge shift over the past sort of 30, 40 years towards lower greenhouse gas emission electricity sources. And then the other big focal area has been transport. And while you can use things like natural gas to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, not get it to zero, while you can use solar and wind to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and while you can use things like nuclear to reduce greenhouse gas emissions when it comes to electricity production, we don't really have a great alternative when it comes to transport. And this is largely where hydrogen has been pursued as an option. And then within the hydrogen stable, one of the focuses has been on this green hydrogen. So obviously hydrogen is just a homogeneous molecule, irrespective of how it's produced, but it's labeled green if it's produced in a certain manner, as you mentioned, using solar and wind. So in and of itself, this isn't necessarily the worst idea, except that hydrogen does suffer from a basic problem of physics, which is volumetric density. So on things where drag, for example, or resistance is a huge problem, like in airplanes, the bulking up of size that you need to store the energy is potentially problematic for transport. It's also problematic when it comes to moving the molecule around the world. So Namibia being far away from the market for green hydrogen, does then, or this volumetric energy density does then become a potential problem in terms of viability when it comes to something like that as well. And so from that perspective, I think there's certainly quite a lot of questions that one can ask about whether the world's actually going to be moving towards hydrogen generally because of volumetric energy density, and then more importantly, moving towards green hydrogen specifically, given that it's got a relatively high cost. And so from that perspective, I think there's a lot of questions still to be asked and answered around hydrogen before we have a hydrogen generally and green hydrogen specifically, before we have great clarity as to whether this is actually where the world is going to go. And in essence, by replacing fossil fuels with this alternative energy source, there's vast, vast change in terms of fueling facilities, in terms of vehicles, in terms of how vehicles are actually powered, and so on, that goes hand in hand with this relatively less optimal source of energy from just a pure energy perspective, not looking at the emission side of things. And so that combined with some of the other issues mentioned really raises some questions as to whether hydrogen in general and green hydrogen specifically are actually going to be the energy of the future.
All right. So let's bring this into the Namibian space at the moment. Economics teaches us to try and exploit your strategic advantages and competitive advantages on a global stage. We have abundant sunshine. We have a very long coastline with very high levels of wind. Every time I go there, it seems to be evident. And we also have, in many cases, a relatively low biodiversity problem to overcome, as opposed to places, for example, like the Amazon and other places that have an enormous amount of this fossil fuel available, but you have to destroy huge biodiversity to get there. So there isn't no biodiversity being destroyed in the process or interfered with, but on a relative basis, it's much lower impact. So from a production of green hydrogen perspective, we have a strategic advantage. If the world says we want it and we'll pay for it, why would Namibia not be wanting to get into that queue?
No, I think in the event that the world said that they want it and they're willing to pay for it, we should be in that queue. That doesn't mean that turning natural parks, national parks, into solar farms is necessarily a good idea. There may be better alternatives than that. And I think that's the point that's been made by the general conservation crowd in Namibia. But I think that it is a bit more complicated than that. So the first thing that I think one should bear in mind is that our relative advantages are probably just three things. So you mentioned all three of them, so solar, wind, and space. Those are probably the only three areas in which we have a natural advantage. We don't have any of the existing infrastructure required. We don't have any of the technical skills or expertise required. We don't have the capital, et cetera, et cetera. So for every advantage, there's at least one disadvantage. And in many instances, those disadvantages are harder to overcome than some of the advantages. So if you take somewhere like Houston as an example, it's got plenty of, or Texas in general, it's got plenty of more significant advantages than us. If you look at places, another big disadvantage that we sit with is distance to market. So if you look at places like parts of Northwest Africa, Saharan Northwest Africa, much, much closer to market, similar wind, similar sunshine, et cetera. So I think that we're massively overselling, just how much of an advantage we have when it comes to solar and wind and how big issues those are vis-a-vis the more complicated issues of skills and capital, existing infrastructure, et cetera. So, but nevertheless, that is absolutely not to say that if the world wants to pay Namibia to buy green hydrogen from Namibia, we should absolutely be willing to provide it, provided we can do so on a, on a basis that's mutually beneficial. And mutually beneficial, a critical part of this is that it's beneficial to Namibia and Namibians.
Of course, another aspect you raise in this article, and you could find the article online, is called Hydrogen Hype, Balancing the Equation, is the issue of green itself is not necessarily well-established in science. It's more of an emotional connection to a particular concept that have been driven by a number of different factors. In and of itself, it's very hard to find fault with trying to find less impactful ways to do things. But the politics of the day do seem to be moving a little bit away, certainly in Western Europe, where we find the most support for these particular subsidies and people willing to pay the cost of what this will take. And so another aspect of it is that the very idea of what green means and what it is also not necessarily easy to pin down and define.
Yeah, so a key thing here that I think is not always well sort of understood is that the objectives of this sort of green movement very much links to that climate change situation that was mentioned previously. But in the subsequent sort of development of this argument, there's a non sequitur that made an appearance, you know, probably 30-odd years ago, which is that because we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, because greenhouse gas emissions are causing climate change, the solution is solar and wind. So while it may be the case that solar and wind are a part of the solution, they're not the only solution, and they may not be the best solution. And what I like to explain around this is that one of the other very obvious options to have, you know, very, very abundant electricity and energy is nuclear. And that was sort of cast by the wayside. And that the overlap between the pro kind of green in the solar and wind space and the anti-nuclear was quite substantial. And unlike solar and wind, not every man and his dog can put up a nuclear power station. And so nuclear tends to be done by nation states, although this is changing rapidly at the moment with data centers and big tech companies starting to look at private nuclear. But historically, nuclear has predominantly been done, or I think almost exclusively been done by nation states. And nation states don't tend to lobby. And so the lobby groups for solar and wind have been very powerful. And they've, as mentioned, overlapped quite a bit with the anti-nuclear lobby groups. Now, that becomes very important because if you look at the issue of greenhouse gas emissions as a sort of core tenet of the idea of green, then solar and wind is just one of the solutions. It's not necessarily the best, and it's certainly not the only solution. The other thing is that green, sort of the green revolution, is defined in two ways. One way, which is a very narrow definition, is that it's a reduction, a targeted reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The other way is that it is a bit broader, which covers ecological protection and a sort of broader idea of environmental protection. And I think that that is probably the more reliable form of green to follow. And that's where things like building solar parks in national parks is starts to become problematic. And that's a big risk for Namibia.
So it's, there's been a lot of work done by the Namibian government to position Namibia as a viable, possible market for this new and emerging technology. We've already established that if people are willing to pay for it and make it, let's see how we get there. But you have already stated the expense that is incurred in creating specifically green hydrogen. And this obviously has a lot to do with the enormous amount of capital expense that's required in the harvesting of wind and solar, and then the conversion from water to hydrogen. It's a very energy-intensive process. And that is perhaps where the economics arguments become the strongest, is who's paying for this? Now, if there's subsidies and you're locked into long-term contracts, someone else is paying for it. It's not quite the issue, but it's unlikely that if Namibia wants to develop an economy in this space, that it's going to come for free.
Yep, and I think that's actually the crux of this issue. So while, you know, we've been pretty skeptical about whether green hydrogen will develop in Namibia at scale, we've been very careful and very considered in what we've said about it, because as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter to me what other people are doing, provided they're using their own resources for that. So, you know, as much as I'm skeptical of whether this space will develop, I'm skeptical of a lot of business ideas that I see in Namibia and elsewhere in the world. Now, to get involved in other people's business affairs and other people's ideas is not what I'm interested in or what we do. And quite frankly, as much as you look upon something like green hydrogen and are skeptical about whether it will work, the hope is that it will. I mean, it's in everyone's interest if hydrogen can develop in Namibia and if it can be done in a commercially viable way. The problem that we sit with at the moment is that hydrogen is an inferior fuel source to the status quo. Green hydrogen is inferior to other forms of hydrogen, such as pink hydrogen or blue hydrogen, both of which can have very low, if inferior in terms of it's got low greenhouse gas, equally low greenhouse gas emissions at a lower price, these alternatives. And at the same time as it's got these problems with inferiority, there is still this sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, but sort of a green aura around the world that means that people may be willing to pay for it. So as much as it doesn't necessarily make a lot of commercial sense, it would be in the interest of the country to add this to the goods and services that we produce and export. The big question is who pays for it. And, you know, it's easy to say that you know, physics and economics are divorced from each other. But at the end of the day, if one is producing a molecule that's not in particularly high demand, because it's relatively cost ineffective when compared to the alternatives, and it therefore needs to be subsidized in order to be utilized and viable, then the big question becomes, who pays that difference? And that's where the economics becomes quite important. And, you know, that's ultimately the crux of our argument here, is that, you know, we very much would like the space to develop. We believe that the investment that's been made into this space from the Namibian government to date, which has mainly been in terms of personnel, and so on, has actually been quite worthwhile. We mentioned in this article that there's 400 jobs created. Now, 400 jobs is not a lot of jobs, but, you know, we've got hundreds of thousands of unemployed people, so every little helps. But the investment in terms of putting Namibia on the map from a government perspective, I think has certainly been worthwhile. And the people involved in selling green hydrogen, I think, are phenomenal salesmen. It's really helping to put Namibia on the global stage. But the next step, which is actually producing this molecule, which will have to be subsidized because of its relative inferiority to both alternative forms of hydrogen and to the status quo in terms of price, becomes a huge question mark that we need to look at. And there's more than one way in which this could be packaged, which is something else that we mentioned here and something else that we want the public to keep an eye on. So the first thing is that we could directly subsidize, you know, something like a large-scale green hydrogen producer by government taking a stake in such a thing and contributing capital to it. And if government can get a commercial return on that capital, that would be fine. But for the reasons I've just mentioned, that's a virtual impossibility at this point. The second thing that one should consider here is that there will be a lot of new infrastructure that's required for this space. Now, if this is infrastructure that can be universally used and has multiple other macro benefits to it, that's again a slightly different situation to a situation where it's exclusively for this space. At the moment, it looks like there will have to be infrastructure developed exclusively for this space, and you're going to end up with the likes of Luderitz, current Luderitz residents paying additional rates and taxes and similar in order to subsidize the development of this space. You're going to find the Namibian taxpayer in general contributing capital towards railway lines or electricity cables or so on in order to subsidize this one industry specifically. And then if one's doing that, then we have to ask a question, which is this a national priority? And the way that you could potentially justify that is to say that, you know, it's got these huge multiplier effects. So we make a bit of a tongue-in-cheek argument in this article about learning the hard way from Air Namibia that subsidizing loss-making entities is not always fun and games. There is actually an argument to be made for Air Namibia in the early days of Air Namibia, which was never well made, I didn't think. But that argument is that the macro benefits of bringing tourists, bringing business people to Namibia far outweighs the financial cost of subsidizing the airline. That, of course, doesn't then mean that there's a sort of green light to spend as much as you want on it. But, you know, as long as the macro benefits outweigh the micro costs, it did make sense for government to subsidize, or the taxpayer rather, to subsidize that. I don't think you can make that argument on hydrogen. I think the fact that it's very low employment, there's very, very limited multiplier effects because we don't have the technology, we don't have the skills, and it's just, as mentioned, very low employment, which is where you often get your additional multiplier effects. It's very difficult to justify public subsidies of this. And the big subsequent question then is, if government is subsidizing this, what is the opportunity cost? What is the foregone use of public funds that we or what could we have used those public funds for that we didn't? And in a country where you have a prime minister saying that 1.4 million people are, you know, facing hunger, where you have, you know, a great shortage of hospitals, where you have a third of the population living in informal housing, etc., I think that there's far greater priorities for the use of public funds. And because this sector is not going to create these big multiplier effects, I don't think it can be justified. Now, a lot of this is premised on the fact that when we look at these numbers, and we're one of the very, very few companies that does social accounting matrix modeling, CGE modeling, etc. in Namibia, we cannot get close to the promised employment figures. You get a short burst during the construction phase, which is a totally unrealistic burst in employment long term. And it's so unrealistic. It's a very short, very intense burst that's so substantial that you can see all of the supporting infrastructure would not be able to deal with it. So it cannot actually happen. And in addition to that, it would require a great deal of external employment in order for anything, you know, of that scale to actually happen. And even then, we're talking about an order of magnitude less than what government's talking about. So you're talking about literally doubling the size of Lüderitz overnight. I mean, this is practically impossible in terms of the electricity infrastructure you need, the water infrastructure, the sewage infrastructure, the road infrastructure, the shops. The boom that's considered is just practically not an achievable boom. And while I think that it's nice to dream about these things, when we start deploying public funds into something that have and where we have so many other demands on the public purse, I think we have to really, you know, wake up a little bit from the dream and look at what is realistic and what may actually be plausible, and rather focus public funds where they're needed, not on subsidizing this green dream.
All right. So this is a very complex series of thoughts and concepts that are coming together into this space, right from the do emissions cause climate change all the way through to can Namibia actually build what is required and who should pay for it. And thank you for summarizing it. Perhaps if I was to just ask you, if you had one sentence to put your viewpoint across to the Namibian public, what are you asking the Namibian public to consider in terms of this particular article?
I think that the critical thing is that we should support the development of a green hydrogen industry in exactly the same way that we should support the development of any industry in the country. If private investors or foreign governments or anybody would like to invest in Namibia and create, you know, shared value as a result of doing so, we should embrace that. And at the same time, we should just be extremely careful about where we deploy public funds. And where there's enormous risk associated with deploying those public funds, we should be very hesitant to do so, especially when the risk is firstly so obvious, and where the downsides are so substantial and where the benefits are actually much, much less than what's being claimed. So while I think one should absolutely support the development of this industry, while one should absolutely support all the initiatives to make Namibia more investable that have in many instances gone with this development of this new industry. So this is a big benefit that we've seen from this is that a lot of the issues that the Namibian private sector has been talking about for a long time in terms of tax regime, in terms of access to infrastructure, pricing of land, these sorts of things, access to work permits, all of these issues have been highlighted again because of this pursuit of green hydrogen. And that's got, you know, these issues very much at the forefront of the government agenda. And while that should certainly be embraced, to use public funds for it, given all of these risks, I think is absolutely sacrilegious and something that we shouldn't even be thinking about.
That's a long sentence, Roland Brown. Thank you very much. And thank you for sharing your views on this. This article is available online. You can go check it out. You can go to Cirrus's website as well. And we'll also be publishing it on futuremedianews.com.na. It's called Hydrogen Hype, Balancing the Equation, written by Roland Brown, economist and co-founder of Cirrus Capital. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
The lead story was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, insight, advice, impact.